Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back on Monday. Israel says it's exploring new ways of supplying Gaza as fallout continues over its deadly raid on an aid flotilla on Monday. Al-Qaeda confirms its number three leader was killed by a CIA drone. And Japan elects its fifth prime minister in 4 years. Joining us for the international hour of our Friday news roundup, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center TV, David Wood of PoliticsDaily.com, and joining the news roundup team for the first time, Howard LaFranchi of the Christian Science Monitor. Well, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning, Susan.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850. Or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, let's start by talking about the situation with Israel. Yesterday, Israel rejected calls for an independent investigation into the deadly raid on a Gaza-bound ship. But, David Wood, they are feeling, it seems, some pressure.
Yeah. I mean, clearly this is an enormous setback for Israel and for the United States as well in the region. I was thinking it illustrates once again the radicalizing consequences of unresolved conflict. And we see this over and over and over again. And in this case, in the Middle East, the lack of tough and visionary leadership.
Nadia, we had an Israeli official reported today that Israel is exploring new ways of allowing goods to get to Gaza. Could that help ease this situation?
Well, look, I think the whole idea of this crisis is focus again on the blockade against Gaza. Israel imposed this blockade in 2007 to punish Hamas and basically to punish the Palestinians more than Hamas, to show them that if you vote for the wrong party, this is what's going to happen. But the international community has been complicit in punishing the Palestinians. You have 1.5 million people living in miserable conditions. And I refer you to the UN reports about how many people living under poverty line, how many kids are suffering from malnutrition. 80% of Gazans are unemployed, and the only employment they have is Hamas. So Israel hasn't succeeded so far, so ultimately they have to do something. The American administration realizing now that is something good has to come out of this crisis, so how can we get Gaza back on the map? How we can get aid to the Palestinians? Now, the Israelis always say for security reasons we cannot allow everything because that will allow arms smuggling. But this argument in the Arab world is seen really as false, basically because Hamas has allowed this smuggling through the tunnels to bring goods, and there is a black market that's flourishing in Gaza. So whether they like it or not, people find an alternative to bring goods regardless of that. But I think it's time for the international community to look again at Gaza and the blockade and the collective punishments of 1.5 million Palestinians.
Well, Howard, what has been the reaction of the international community?
Well, I think we've seen, first of all, the United States standing out really separate. As Nadia mentioned, the Obama administration says it, you know, wants to use this as an opportunity to kill a few birds with one stone. They want to use this to pressure Israel on moving forward with proximity talks that would then move towards push the peace process forward. They're also pressuring Israel, saying, look, you know, we're your greatest advocate when it comes to Iran, but this whole imbroglio has put off, for example, the Security Council resolution of additional sanctions on Iran. So you have the United States really trying to use its place as Israel's friend. On the other hand, you have pretty much a united international community, whether it's the Europeans and most, opposing and in quite harsh terms what Israel is doing with this blockade. And standing out there is Turkey, because Turkey was Israel's friend and a very important friend. It's chief friend in the Muslim world. And this incident, which took place on a Turkish flagged ship, has really turned Turkey against Israel, has really upended those relations. And I think that the United States is also trying to pull them back together and trying to find ways to use this again to stop this deterioration of Israel and those friends that it has.
Well, we've also learned that a U.S. citizen was among those who were killed, a U.S. citizen of Turkish origin. And we have an email from Paul in Kensington, Maryland, who asked, do we know the administration's response to the unsettling reality that an Israeli soldier killed an American in international waters? David?
I don't think we know much of either about the circumstances or the consequences of this. Clearly, it's a tragedy. But again, you know, it strikes me that on one side you have Israel saying we have an absolute right under international law to defend ourselves, and that includes stopping arms going to what it terms terrorist organizations in Gaza. On the other hand, you have the people who ran the flotilla saying we have an absolute moral right, and I think they're both right in this regard, that we have an absolute moral right to come to the aid of beleaguered Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So, you know, this young American who was killed unfortunately gets caught in between these two huge conflicting drives. And that's why, again, I say the lack of tough visionary leadership in this situation is just staggering.
Nadia, the problem here is not that Israel has the right or not the right to stop or intercept ships in midwater, and some Arab countries and Turkey call it piracy, basically, in mid-sea. But the way they did it, I mean, you have a highly trained commando unit, it's just like the Navy SEAL, which is an elite unit in the Israeli army, taking on a civilian protester peace activist. And these ships, if they have arms, they were inspected by the Turkish ports before they came. And this argument the Israeli put forward that they have links to terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, actually it didn't sell well at all, because if this is the case, they detained them afterwards and they released him immediately after Turkey said, if you don't release him immediately, that's it. It's the end of our relationship. So nobody bought this argument, in fact. Whether it was legal or not, I mean, that's to the international lawyers to debate it. But the bottom line is, set a precedence. What does it stop any other country, whether it's rogue or not, to stop a ship in the middle of the sea and said, we're going to do it because the Israeli did it.
Howard.
Yes, I was just saying, I mean, we do know that the American ambassador in Turkey contacted the family of the young man, Turkish, but American-born Turkish citizen, and so American citizen as well. And, of course, we had President Obama expressing his condolences for loss of life. And I think Nadia's right that there's so much debate going on. Certainly, if there's strong debate going on here, we can imagine the debate going on in Israel, in Turkey, and you have, you know, was it legal? It was not legal. But what it comes down to is that nine of these protesters or aid deliverers were killed, and none of the Israeli commandos was killed. Some were injured. But so when you try to make this argument, it's putting the Israeli government in a corner that the Americans want to try them, pull them out of.
Well, David, you talked about the lack of bold leadership in the region and the consequences of that. So what could and should the Obama administration do at this point?
Well, I think calling for a transparent, not just calling for, but making happen, a transparent international investigation into what was on the ship, for one thing, but then looking for alternative ways and having the international community validate and oversee the opening of Gaza to at least humanitarian aid. But as I understand it, the bigger problem there is a lack of jobs. So, you know, all that needs to happen under the international community. I think that's very clear, and I think the Obama administration should really step in and direct that effort.
And, of course, the Obama administration has had some problems in its relationship with Israel. How does that factor into this?
Well, I always say, I don't know what is it about the Israelis and timing. You know, the administration sends Vice President Biden to the region, and he's the most ardent supporter of the Jewish state. And the Israelis receive him by announcing that they're going to build 1,600 housing units and expand the settlements. And it was a slap in the face. And then the administration realized that we have to deal with Netanyahu. It's too long for us to wait till he is voted out. So basically, we have to deal with with him. So it was like welcoming him to the White House. And look at the timing. Again, it was a day before the meeting it's supposed to take place, and the Israelis go, and we have this fiasco on the ship. So I think that the problem is now, it's seen in the wider context in the Middle East, that some Arab countries are calling for the withdrawal of the Arab peace plan, which is very significant, because this is the only proposal that they put forward for the Israelis and the Palestinians with American support, that if you want peace, this is what we want. Israel withdraw to the 67 border. Some countries now saying, well, look, Israel doesn't understand anything but the language of force. No longer the peace options are available. Saying that, I think the administration now has more leverage than the Israeli government than before. Because if you look at the condemnation, as Dave said, it was basically very lukewarm. It was not the expectation from the Muslim world, considering President Obama going to Cairo. He wants to mend relations, but when it comes to Israel, he still shies away from full criticism. And he can use this to pressure Prime Minister Netanyahu to say, the only thing we can do it is come here. We need to sit down on the negotiating table, move forward from proximity talks to direct negotiation. And this is what the administration wants to do when President Abbas comes next week.
But we had saw a cover story in Foreign Policy magazine this week that questioned whether the U.S. could and should play this kind of central role in Middle East negotiation that it's played traditionally. Is that a real debate,
yeah,
David?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real debate. But one of the interesting things that's going on in the wake of this flotilla disaster or fiasco, as Nadia referred to it, is that both Iran and Turkey are now jostling to be the regional superpower. I mean, to the extent that Israel is seen or can be painted as the bully in the neighborhood, you have now people like, I see the Iranians are already stepping up and saying, this proves we need to be strong and, parentheses, develop our nuclear weapons.
So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about those elections in Iraq. 3 months later, they've finally been certified. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio for our weekly news roundup on international topics, Howard LaFranchi, the foreign affairs correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Nadia Bilbasi, I know I'm saying that right, mm-hmm. senior U.S. correspondent for NBC-TV, MCB-TV, the Middle East Broadcast Center. So it's NBC. And David Wood, he's national security correspondent for Politics Daily. Well, Iraq's High Court ratified the results of the national elections that were held on March 7th. Howard, who won?
Well, according to the Supreme Court ruling, well, basically what they did was verify that the bloc led by Ayad Alawi, who is a secular Shiite, that his bloc won the most seats. The problem is they didn't win anything near a majority. Coming in second, just a few seats behind, was the bloc of the current Prime Minister, Maliki. And so now, although it sounds great that, okay, finally there's a ruling and the results have been certified, but now the jockeying and the power struggle shifts to the parliament because someone is going to have to come up with a coalition that will be a majority to be able to form the government. last or recently anyway, Maliki sort of envisioning this, formed a coalition with the forces of the Islamic Shiite movement of Sadr, a name that I think many Americans will be familiar with. But the question will be the right to try to form a government will go first to Alawi, and the question will be if he will be able to succeed.
And Nadia, is this taking longer than we expected?
Oh, I think every time I come on the Diane Rehm show, I ask the same question. When are they going to form the government? And I think I don't have an answer. Probably September. I mean, it's a good thing that the highest judicial body in Iraq has certified the results, because that means that they're not disputed anymore. And we heard from Prime Minister Maliki. He said, no, we won. We have to recount it by hand. We have to do this. We have to do that. So now it's over. Except for two seats that was disputed. I thought it will ultimately, it's not going to affect the results. As we said, it stands now as 91 and 89 for Alawi. The problem now, it is jockeying for power. Who's going to form the government? And funny enough, it reminds me of Israel, because if you remember, Kadima won the election, but they couldn't form the government, and therefore they lost. So it doesn't mean the winning party who got the popular vote will ultimately form the government. What we've seen now is actually Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki trying to go in coalition with the third largest bloc, which is the Iraqi National Alliance, which includes Sadr and Hakim and others. The problem is people already see it as a Shiite domination. And it's not just Shiite domination, but Shiite religious domination. And that will alienate the secularists and the Sunnis. So the problem now is where do you go now? The president, Jalal Talabani, has 15 days to ask the parliament to convene. And after they nominate the speaker and the deputy speakers, they will go forward now to ask the winning party, which is Iyad Alawi, and his Araqiya party, to form the government.
Now, Nadia says that the government can't be formed until September. We have an August deadline for the reduction of U.S. troop levels in
Iraq. I hope it's before.
Yeah, we hope it's before, but it's obviously taken quite a bit of time and no end quite yet in sight. Could this imperil that timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops, David?
I don't think so, Susan. We're going to have General Ray Odierno, who's the top U.S. commander in Iraq, briefing at the Pentagon in about an hour. So we'll get an answer from him. But he met with President Obama this week, and what he said was that the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops is on track, and they will all be gone by August 31st. About 50,000 U.S. military personnel will be left in Iraq, but let me stress, they are not organized in fighting units. And, you know, they are largely technicians and administrators, and so if violence does break out and the U.S. is needed, that we'll have to come back in from the outside.
All right. Let's turn to our callers and let them join our conversation with their comments and questions. We'll go first to Fort Worth, Texas, and talk to Sam. Sam, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a history graduate student, and I've done a considerable amount of research on the status of foreign blockade runners in international law during the American Civil War. And I think that the Gaza situation is directly analogous to that more familiar blockade to Americans. I feel like there's a great deal.
Sam, are you there? Well, I'm afraid that we lost Sam, but he made the point about, is this analogous to some incidents in our own history? Howard, what do you think?
Well, I can't say I'm an expert on the Civil War blockade, but one thing I find interesting is that we're finding a lot of Irish involvement in the anti-blockade movement. And from what I understand, there's quite a strong feeling, not only because there's like many European countries, interest in the seen as the Palestinian cause, but also the Irish, looking back to the era of the potato famine, when Irish not only were products kept out of Ireland because the British needed them elsewhere, but Irish in some cases were prohibited from leaving, from emigrating from the country. And only worsening the conditions, the living conditions of the Irish. So I find it interesting that is motivating what is turning out to be a large contingent, and it's also a part of the boat that is approaching Gaza at this very moment. There are a number of Irish parliamentarians, I understand, on that ship, the Rachel Corrie, and so we'll see what happens there. But there is that Irish connection.
Nadia, just to add, actually, the most prominent probably on this boat that's left the Irish shores and now heading to Gaza probably in a few hours is Mairead Maguire, who's a Nobel Peace laureate, very well known woman. She's in her 70s and she's one of the participants on it. And I think the Gaza Free Movement, who organized ships or the flotillas, basically, they come from every corner of the world, including former U.S. diplomats. We've seen Ambassador Edward Pick, who was on one of them. We have seen parliamentarians from Europe, from Latin America, from Turkey. So it wasn't just like an Islamic movement who sympathized with
Israelis
the plight.
As well.
Israelis peace activists, and one Holocaust survivor was among them. So I think the idea behind it, as I did some contact and some research with them, is basically to draw international attention to the plight of the civilians in Gaza. What can we do to break this blockade? And it's supposed to be nonviolent.
Now, we have an email for Nadia saying, for journalistic integrity, reveal Nadia's background and allegiances. Would you just tell us a little about that?
it's a bit strange question. I don't have allegiance to anybody, to any party. My only allegiance is to my job as a professional journalist. I've been a foreign correspondent for 25 years. I covered Africa for 10 years, South Asia for 4, Europe for 4, been in America for 7 years. I'm of Palestinian origin, and I carry Irish citizenship as well.
Huh. Nadia, if I might just intervene there, I remember when I was being kicked out of Cuba once, and I was told by someone in the foreign ministry that I was not a friend of Cuba, and I said, well, I'm a journalist. It's not a question of being a friend of a government, or it's being a journalist.
Here's another email. This emailer asked, could Turkey use its middle of the dispute position to be an aid in negotiating peace, or am I just dreaming? This from Joe in Gainesville. David Wood, is Joe dreaming?
What a nice dream, though. I think the difficulty there is that Turkey is so deeply enmeshed on one side of this that I think its usefulness as a middle position here is probably limited.
June 12th is the one-year anniversary of the disputed re-election of President Ahmadinejad in Iran. So, Howard, what are we hearing from the opposition in terms of marking this occasion?
Well, first of all, I find it interesting that we were discussing during the break that things in Iran have been pretty quiet over this week of focus on the Gaza blockade issue. And one thing I'm hearing is that the government has actually discouraged large demonstrations. Normally they would have in the past, it seems, if you go by past history. But there were concerns about those large demonstrations, where they might turn, where they might go, because the opposition has said that it wants to mount a large national protest to mark the anniversary. But you also have, before June 12th, you have the anniversary of the death of the Iranian revolutionary leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini. So what we're hearing is that actually a large number of paramilitary soldiers from around the country are being moved into Tehran by the Revolutionary Guard to kind of keep a lid on things.
Nadia, I think the regime will show a zero tolerance policy towards the protesters. It's not just that they're making it difficult for them to convene and to demonstrate, but I think the Revolutionary Guard themselves declared that any demonstration is going to be seen as an act of war against the state. There's a campaign of intimidation. If you look at the most successful of the opposition leaders' campaign was through the non-conventional means, meaning YouTube, YouTube, SMS, emails, telephone calls, and apparently now, even when they try, and foreign journalists trying to call the opposition leaders, they won't get their phone answered back because they worry that the regime is tapping them. So I think we're not going to see a massive demonstrations like we've seen immediately in the aftermath of the election, because the opposition has been under an immense pressure from the regime, worrying actually that something bad is going to happen. It's not just talking about arrests, and as we have seen it, but also execution. If you have seen, there is signal, the regime signaling that we are dead serious about who's in charge here. In the last few months, there has been 6 executions. 5 of them were Kurds as well. It was a message for Mujahideen Khalq, which is an organization that works against the regime. There is also the Kurds. There is the opposition. And there is talk even that maybe the regime will go that far to arrest Karoubi and Mousavi. So we have to watch. But I think my prediction that we're not going to see anything similar to the demonstrations, to the immediate, enthusiasm that something can be done after the election, that the election was illegitimate and illegal, and therefore we can change it, change the situation. I don't think it's going to happen soon.
You know, we've seen this clampdown, but we also saw Iran pardon or give early release to 81 protesters who had been imprisoned after previous demonstrations. What's the message there?
I think the message, Susan, is that the regime in Tehran is really undecided about how to deal with this enormous outpouring of public opposition. It's a very difficult thing for any government, but particularly for one that's attempting to control the state through coercion.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850, and you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, just this morning, we saw peace talks in Afghanistan wrap up with a decision to call on the government to begin peace talks with the Taliban. Howard, what's going on?
Well, it was interesting at the conclusion of this 3-day jirga, a peace meeting that Karzai had called, that this assembly of about 1,500 tribal leaders and other leaders brought in from all over the country, they called for launching talks really with the Taliban. Now, this to a certain extent, I think this might go farther than what the U.S. government had anticipated. If you recall that when Karzai was here in Washington not too long ago, the U.S., which has been uncomfortable with this idea of negotiations with the Taliban, sort of laid down what the ground rules of what I recall as Secretary Clinton it was a public conversation with Karzai, but she said that they would have to renounce violence, renounce any connection to Al Qaeda, and abide by all the provisions of the Afghan Constitution, and among other things, the rights of women in Afghanistan. But there was an emphasis on low, and if it was going to happen at all, on low and mid-level fighters, those that Karzai referred to as countryside boys who were only doing it for the money. So I think that's where the question is going to be, is if it ever occurs, this these talks and negotiations, if it does, what level it reaches up to. I think that will be one of the chief questions.
David.
There's a good tip-off about this whole situation. If you look back at previous reconciliation and reintegration efforts in Afghanistan, they've been entirely botched, corrupt, mismanaged, and in the end, utterly futile. Right back to 2001, when some of the senior al-Qaeda people made tentative feelers to the government, they were immediately snatched up and taken off to Guantanamo. So right from the very beginning, it was cleared. And as we speak, there are about a half dozen low-level reconciliation or reintegration programs going on, largely funded by the international community. But they, too, have been botched in this way. One group was promised land certificates and seed so that they could start a new life. They came in from the Taliban and they never got what they were promised. There were several warlords who were told, if you bring your guys in, turn over your weapons, we'll take care of you. They brought their guys in, turned over their weapons, and got nothing. So So I think the level of expectation among Afghans I've talked to is extremely low.
Nadia?
I think it's also ironic that President Karzai's call for reconciliation has fallen on deaf ears, literally. As he was convening this peace jirga, you know, the Taliban launched two rocket attacks that almost, you know, I mean, I don't know if it killed him, but it basically rushed him out of the place, including the American ambassador there. And the Taliban showed that they're able to strike that close to the president. The criticism against this kind of jirga is it was, as they said, it was like full of warlords. And the president has assigned, Burhanuddin Rabbani, which was a former president and is considered, again, one of the warlords, to be in charge. I mean, he's not going to be able to negotiate with the Taliban. The American administration, as you said, when Karzai was here with President Obama in the White House, he said, Obama said clearly, we have conditions for the Taliban to join. They have to denounce violence. They have to lay down their arms. They have to recognize, legit international laws and legitimacy and whatever. But unless these conditions are met, they're not going to be part of the government. President Karzai actually appealed to them in a very affectionate term. He called them Talib John, which is a Pashtun word used like my friend, come and join me, you know, it's all going to be good for the sake of the country. But he's caught in a rock and hard place because the Taliban said, we're not going to join you unless the foreign forces is leaving the country. And at the same time, he needs them to have legitimacy and to have some kind of stability in Afghanistan.
Nadia Bilbasi, she's senior U.S. correspondent for the Middle East Broadcast Center. And we're also joined by David Wood and Howard Lutfranchi. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Ayelet Waldman talks about some of the experiences she's faced as a wife and mother that led her to name her memoir Bad Mother, including the aftermath of writing an essay where she confessed she loved her husband more than her children. Bad Mother just came out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Al-Qaeda has said its number three leader has been killed. U.S. analysts say they believe this report to be true. Howard, who was he?
Yes, he was the he had two names, but Al-Masri. Mm-hmm. He was some listeners will probably recall the attack on the post in Khost in Afghanistan, and it's believed that he organized that very successful, unfortunately, attack that took a number of lives of CIA agents in Afghanistan. And he was it appears he was the victim, and this is as you said, Susan, that claimed by or acknowledged by Al-Qaeda itself, that he was, an operational figure and number three. As a number of people have pointed out, it seems like we're always getting the number three person of Al-Qaeda, never number one or number two. It's always number three. and but he was the operational, seen as a certain mastermind in terms of these kinds of attacks.
Nadia, how important is this?
Well, he's important because he was the chief financial operation for Al-Qaeda. So he's the money guy. So he's important in that sense. But also, I think he's important because he was one of the closest confidant of Osama bin Laden. He spent time with him in Sudan. He was one of the people who actually spent time in jail with Ayman Zawahiri, number two. And they were accused of plotting to assassinate former President Anwar Sadat. He's important in a sense that any time for the intelligence community that you take a top tier of Al-Qaeda is good news. But does it mean, and of course he has a role in organizing with other Islamist groups in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Uzbekistan. But in the same time, what does it mean? You know, you get rid of even him or even Osama bin Laden. Does Al-Qaeda really exist now as an operational body? Everybody thinks now that it is more of an idea, the franchise now. So if you look at Al-Qaeda work, the most significant that we have seen recently is they go by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in Bilad al-Rafidain in Iraq. So, and if we have seen the recent attack, whether it's Muttalib or Shahzad or others, they're inspiring a new generation of radicals, of extremists, so people who have a problem with the regime or with the country or with America, or with Israel, to go on to be recruited by them, to be trained, whether it was good training or not, as we have seen in the New York attack, basically to go and launch an attack. So I think the fact that he is killed is good news, as I said, for the intelligence community, but it's not necessarily on an operational level is very significant.
This happened, we think, about 2 weeks ago, David Wood. Why is it just being confirmed now?
Well, because the what happens in North Waziristan, which is a pretty remote part of the world, is pretty opaque to the rest of us on the outside. And there have been lots and lots of claims about senior Al-Qaeda and Taliban people being killed, and then they pop up a couple months later. So the only way to make doubly and triply sure is to send in a special forces team, and they take DNA and work it from there.
Did that happen in this case?
I can't say whether it did or not. Not because I... not allowed to, but because I don't know. But I think that the thing that strikes me about this, one thing we've learned about knocking off senior terrorist figures is that they almost always are replaced by someone more radical because, you know, the guy stepping up into that job wants to prove that he's tougher, that he's worthy of the post, and that he, you know, wants to make a big impact. The other interesting thing is, as Nadia was saying, is that I think it's less important that there's an Al-Qaeda structure in any particular place. So one thing you didn't mention when you were going through Al-Qaeda in Yemen and Al-Qaeda in Somalia is Al-Qaeda in Times Square, which sort of proves the point.
Yeah, I mean, Shahzad, I mentioned that. But one point to add is basically Al-Qaeda claimed him in one of the Islamist websites as dead. And very often they don't really come forward and say that. Yeah. So this is one of the indication that we know for sure probably it was him. And apparently, according to reports, he was killed with his wife, three kids, grandchildren, and other people in this attack.
Is there a reaction when not only the Al-Qaeda leader is killed, but when we see children and family members killed as well?
Well, yes, of course. And I think the context of this attack is important because, yes, it appeared he was killed by a drone attack. And we've just had this report from from a United Nations special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, but really finding fault with the U.S. policy on drones, and this at a time when actually the Obama administration is stepping up the use of drones beyond what the Bush administration did. Maybe President Obama, when he was a candidate, tipped us off to that because he told us, we will recall in one of the debates, that he would do this. But so there's this debate going on because you kind of have, as Nadia was saying, okay, so you have this senior Al-Qaeda leader killed. That's great from the point of view of the intelligence community, but you have other casualties as well. And from the perspective of counterinsurgency, if that's really what we're about, most importantly in Afghanistan, there, then you know the question is: does this kind of attack, does it set back the interests of your counterinsurgency work? Even though it's great in terms of your counterterrorism work.
And what do you think about that? Does it, on balance, is it so worth doing that you take the reaction from the population in terms of counterinsurgency?
I think if you're talking to the military and intelligence community, they will say yes, but it's very controversial because, as we said, there's always going to be a civilian casualty. I mean, Al-Qaeda number 3 or number 1 or number 10 is always guilty, but what about his wife and his kids and his grandchildren? Are they also guilty by association? Does a democracy has the right to take them off as well? And this is going to be an important debate, I think, on many layers. It's not just in the Arab and Muslim world. The other point is it always creates more recruit. When you kill innocent civilians in any circumstances, it creates a resentment towards that person who did the attack. So it will be easier recruit ultimately in the long run for this organization to say, look what the Americans are doing, or look at this or that party, how they have no regard for human life and human suffering, and therefore don't you want to join us and revenge for the death of your father? So it is really a policy that need to be weighed on so many levels.
It's pretty clear, Susan, that we're in this era of persistent warfare, as the Pentagon and lots of other people call it, and that we haven't figured out how to operate in this world. The Israelis haven't. The peace protesters clearly haven't. As I say, you know, there is a clash between moral right and legal right. With this drone war, you know, there's also this advantage-disadvantage problem. We have not figured out how to do this, and so what we writ large are doing seems clumsy and awkward and at times really counterproductive. We got to figure this out.
I mentioned the UN report, and one of the solutions, anyway, mentioned in this report, at least recommended, a transfer from the CIA of responsibility for these drone attacks to the military, because it's the sense that the military is more accountable, and that the military, because it is running the counterinsurgency operations, that they are watching more carefully for this residual damage that can come. So we'll see. So far, the CIA has been very defensive and not wanting to give up that duty. But we should also recall that I guess it was back in February, there was this a drone attack that killed 23 Afghans, and it was found that was a completely mistaken attack, and that was not carried out by the CIA. That was a military operation, and General McChrystal, the commanding officer in Afghanistan, was very critical of that. And so I think there are efforts anyway to try to figure it out. But as David said, there is just going to be this tension between the two.
In South Korea this morning, the prime minister said his country has referred North Korea to the UN Security Council over that ship that was sunk. Nadia, are tensions easing on the Korean Peninsula, or are they getting worse?
I don't think it's easing, but at the same time, if you look when Pyongyang wants some attention, then they will come with an incident like this. Just to remind the viewers, this has happened in March 26 when South Korean warship was hit by a torpedo, and according to multinational investigation, it shows that it came from North Korea. As a result, 46 sailors were killed. If you look at the reaction from the United States, from Japan, from the South Korea, it was seen as an act of provocation. If you look at North Korea, we've seen a recent visit of to China, and basically President Kim said, well, this is a revenge attack for something that happened before, and we don't bypass any revenge attack. We need to retaliate immediately. But in the long run, I think the key word here is China. If they're going to condemn North Korea and the Security Council, they need China to be on board. For the time being, the Chinese are weighing all the options. The most important thing for them is stability. If they're going to push for further sanction that will punish the regime, basically it might crumble, and then what you have in the process. But in the same time, how can you let them go without being punished? There is fear as well that if they go ahead and come with this new set of sanctions, that the North Korean, in a predictable pattern, will go for another nuclear test, and that will even inflame things further. The situation is tense. I don't think they will. It will go to war. It's always we come very close since the end of the Korean War till now. It's always been this problems between the North and the South. The question again is, will the administration revive the six-party talks? And I think this is vital if you really wanted to get something, or at least to deflate the attention that President Kim wants all the time by giving him some kind of format to operate and to be inclusive as opposed to be outside of the process.
We talked in the first hour about the midterm elections coming up in the United States. They had midterm elections in South Korea, and the ruling party did not do so well, suffered some setbacks. David, was that a reflection of concern in South Korean public opinion about the kind of hard stance the government had taken after this incident?
Are you talking about Japan or South Korea? In South Korea. You know, I'm just not up to speed on that.
My understanding, again, I talked to a couple of people yesterday, and interestingly enough, it seems that there was, among South Koreans in general, a kind of reaction to what they found to be a too tough approach by their government. And so using, as often does, but with midterm elections, as we may find out in November, but using those elections to send a message back to their own government. Because, of course, the current president, President Lee, is tougher in his line towards the North than the previous leader. And it seems like it was just perhaps a message was being sent.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've been taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Well, Japan has a new prime minister this morning. Nadia, what do we know about him?
Well, it's really interesting because in 4 years, I think you have four prime ministers. So I don't know if Japanese democracy...
Fifth, actually.
If Japanese democracy is healthy or very unstable. But the previous prime minister, Hatoyama, basically was there for less than 8 months. We couldn't even make the year. And in a way, it was a setback for his party because he broke this monopoly for so long and the Liberal Democrats came to power. But it seems that he was unable to fulfill his commitment to the voters in terms of moving the U.S. base in Okinawa, and also to bring Japan again into the from economic decline that's been seen in the last two decades or so. So I think the voters has punished him, and he has no option but to apologize for the voters and say, I'm out. So we will see if this prime minister will last and what's his ideas forward and the implication of relationship particularly with the United States and how he will go forward.
Well, why did the exiting prime minister go back on his campaign promise and agree to let that Marine base on Okinawa stay?
Well, he had campaigned, Susan, on this whole idea of moving Japan out from under what some see as an onerous U.S. military protective umbrella, and was very firm in his determination to do that. The problem was, as he explained in his tearful resignation speech the other day, was that Japan is just not ready to defend itself. The Japanese people seem very undecided about this idea. Of course, they don't want a big U.S. military presence visible in Japan. As one Japanese columnist said this week, they're treating us like the spoils of war. On the other hand, you have the rising Chinese military threat, North Korea acting up again, and it's a dangerous neighborhood. And as the retiring or resigning prime minister said, you know, it's clear that Japan is not ready to defend itself.
And so how is the new prime minister likely to deal with this issue of the base in Okinawa that was so controversial for his predecessor, Howard?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to note that he is the well, now he's the new prime minister, but in the previous government that is just ending, he was the finance minister, and Japan is suffering from years and years of really economic stagnation, and I think that I think he's signaled that he's really going to turn his focus there. He made a point of saying, you know, yes, we have to settle this issue with the Americans. He downplayed the question that was really brought to the forefront by the previous Prime Minister Hatoyama about expanding Japan's reach in Asia and reaching out to China. And But I'm not sure that it's clear. I mean, Hatayama did accept finally the agreement, which goes back to 2006 before he left. And it'll be this new prime minister's role to sort of push this through. But it seemed like he was signaling that, you know, that's a hot potato. I'm going to, yes, we're going to resolve it, but I'm really going to focus on the economy.
Valerie sent us a question on Facebook saying, please discuss the view of our oil spill from the perspective of folks in the UK. Are they wondering why there are such lax drilling standards here? Nadia, not just the UK, but has there been an international reaction to the oil spill we're dealing with here in the United States?
Of course, because it's a huge environmental disaster. I mean, if you look at it from every perspective, it's heart-wrenching just to see the pictures, as we've seen today, of what's happening in the Gulf Coast. So the international committee is very much interested in that. And again, it brings to focus the problem of offshore drilling and the consequences that you might have a disaster like this. But also, they're talking about international help. Is the Americans are able to do it alone or not? If not, why are they not asking for international help?
Nadia Bilbasi, Howard LaFranchi, and David Wood, thank you so much for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane. She'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.